You are listening to WEWN, Birmingham, Alabama, USA, a Catholic radio service of the Eternal Word Television Network.
I'm Chris Noble, and welcome back to our second show on Catholic Apologetics. I'm going to talk about, in this show, the existence of God. Does he exist or doesn't he? It's really a very simple question. The answer is either yes or no, obviously. Either God does exist or God doesn't exist. But everybody is involved in this mystery, and everyone on the face of the earth is involved in this question. You can't get free of this question. The mystery of God's existence is something that is part of all of our lives. It's not a problem. The mystery of God's existence is not a problem to be solved. It's a mystery to be lived, to exist in. God is involved in all our lives. Now, there's an inseparable question that follows. What is God's nature? And we'll discuss that. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the talk. But the question right now that I want to talk about and deal with is the existence of God. Does God exist? So that's the question we're going to put here. First question, does God exist? Yes or no? And I suspect that if Sherlock Holmes began to study the universe to decide whether or not there was a God, I think he'd come up with the answer in the affirmative. He said in one of his novels, or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle said that Sherlock Holmes decided that there was a God because there were flowers and there must be beauty in the universe and something to create them. In any case, Blaise Pascal in the 17th century said that there are two types of human beings, one afraid to lose God and the other afraid to find him. And I think that sums it up pretty well. I think that's a pretty profound statement. There can be a lot of reasons why somebody rejects God. There can be many different reasons. And I'm not going to talk about any individuals or judge anybody's conscience. That's not our business. That's between that individual and the Lord. So we're not judging people. We're just trying to present the argument for the existence of God. So the first thing I talk about in this whole question is the biblical approach to God. The biblical approach to the person who denies God's existence and to one who accepts God's existence. The Bible is very clear about somebody who denies God's existence. It says that sin is the root of all error. And somebody is a non-believer, or somebody doesn't believe in God primarily because of an act of choice, not because of their beliefs, because of a vagary of mind, but because of an act of choice, because of one's will. That's why somebody does not believe in God. It is a choice. In Psalm 14, the psalmist talks about the fool. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Now, in the scriptures, that person is not denying God's existence. The ancient question wasn't whether God existed or not, but his active presence in the midst of his people. Even though that's what's going on here, he's contrasted with a wise man, in the next verse, who seeks God and does recognize his presence among God's people. The fool is compared with the stupid man or the senseless man in Psalm 92. And those two, the fool is compared in the senseless man and the stupid man with the wicked man. And this is a quote later down in the psalm, though they flourish like grass and all evildoers thrive, they are destined for eternal destruction. The foolishness and senselessness is not depicted as innocent. It's not depicted as something that's not a person's fault. Psalm 10, verses 3 to 4, for the wicked man glories in his greed and the covetous blasphemes and sets aside the Lord at naught, pushes God aside or curses him. And it says later that the wicked man believes that God will not punish him for his curses. Now, the biblical understanding of the fool doesn't deal with God's existence as an actual reality, like we said. But the modern issue is, does God exist at all? For the ancient person, they all believed in God. They were somehow close enough to God in some way that wasn't a question. The question was, is God with us? Now the question is, it's evolved into, is there any kind of a God at all? John Courtney Murray, in a book called The Problem of God, said that the Bible clearly locates the ultimate root of atheism not in an erroneous judgment of the mind, but an act of choice made somehow in the name of freedom that launches the project of the godless life. For this act, man is responsible. The biblical verse is not doubtful. Thus, to choose existence without God is to choose non-existence or absurdity. So ultimately, belief in the existence of God or denial of the existence of God depends upon the deepest act of freedom a human being can make. The will to faith or the will to disbelief comes from this choice, this freedom in a person. That's not just a choice, but it's determining who we are. We are determined by our choices. And the choice for or against God will determine who we are for eternity. It's the most profound choice a person can make. There's no deeper choice anyone can make. Now, when someone makes the choice against God, they begin to fall into absurdity. They begin to fall into what the scriptures would say is non-existence. Non-existence. I'm accepting my own existence when I accept and recognize God's existence. But I reject my own existence, reject it, when I refuse to recognize and accept God. The people who reject God do not have any foundation for their life, because human life is based upon concrete, actual, spiritual reality. To be a human being is to be spiritual and material. And to reject the spiritual part of us is to reject the foundation upon which we live and which we stand and how we exist. Biblically speaking, these people are in a state of non-existence. They make no sense. They're absurd. Luke 1:79 says, "These people sit in darkness in the shadow of death." And that's a tragic, tragic thing. It's a tragic thing that occurs at all. The ancient wise men of Israel encountered another kind of godless man, the godless philosopher. And the godless philosopher would be somebody who studies the beauty of creation and all of creation, the forces of the cosmos and all these kinds of things, and begins to idolize it, begins to worship the creation rather than the creator. That's another kind of stance towards God that is a form of atheism, a form of non-existence. The Bible is a little bit gentler with those people because they are truly seeking God. Now, let's talk about the proofs for God's existence. The proofs for God's existence are not scientific. We're not dealing here with scientific experiments that are empirically verifiable, something we can see through the senses. A proof is more like evidence in a courtroom. A proof is not infallible. It doesn't force someone to believe in Christ. Okay? It doesn't force you to believe anything. It's just like you get some information here and you get a choice, a new choice on whether to believe or not. So a proof is like evidence in a courtroom. It's not scientific for the five senses, but it's for the heart. Also, a proof is reasonable, and it shows us that it is reasonable and it is a rational act to believe in God. There are many, many objections to proofs for God, for the existence of God. And if you read any kind of philosophy, you'll see that there's many of them, and they've been here for quite a while. One of the most famous arguments against the existence of God was by Ludwig Feuerbach, who lived in the 19th century. He's called the high priest of modern atheism. And he has what he called the projection theory. And what this is that the idea of God originates in our minds and in our hearts because we have needs. We have need for truth. We have need for immortality. We have need for security and happiness. And because we have these needs, we make up a God. We create this God to answer our needs, to answer our needs. And it's just simply a projection. It's simply a projection. Now, Peter Kreeft is a philosopher at Boston University and has written some wonderful apologetic books. He said, "If the idea of God is a fantasy, a human invention, it is the greatest invention in all of human history. It's the absolutely greatest invention in all human history." And I'll go into that more in the talk about Christ, about his character and who he was and what kind of a person is depicted in the Gospels here, and why do people believe in him? Why is he so credible? But it's true. How could somebody invent this Jesus Christ, who is beyond our wildest imagination? Nobody in all of the history of religions has ever invented a personality like this. If I invented God, God would be inconsistent, he'd be moody, he'd be angry, he'd get in fights, he'd be impatient, he'd be distant, unloving. I couldn't conceive of anything greater than myself. I would base my invention of God on my own existence. God would be a God satisfying my own needs, He would be nothing like a holy God, probably nothing like a loving God either, and he would be made in my image and likeness, rather than I being made in his image and likeness. So that argument from Feuerbach has some holes in it. It's something that I don't think attests to human experience and human reality. Now, I'm going to go through a few arguments here for the existence of God, proofs for the existence of God, and talk about them, and just go through some of the most famous ones. There are over 25 different arguments for the existence of God. There's a book out called Does God Exist? And in that book, Christian philosophers argue with atheist philosophers, and on the Christian side, there are over 25 arguments for God. So, you see, this mystery of God's existence, you can come at it from many different ways. It's like a diamond with many facets, and you can look at it from many sides of the diamond and see that I can approach the existence of God from many, many different angles. Many different angles. I find the arguments against the existence of God to be really basically narrow and coming from one point, and that's from a set of philosophical presuppositions. So the richness of the argument for the existence of God is an argument in itself for his existence. But let's talk about the argument from design. This is one of my favorite arguments, and it's one of the most clear, and it's one of the most easy to explain to people, the argument from design. The major premise is that if there is design somewhere, there's a designer. You know, if I see order and beauty and a rationale, let's say, a rational structure or something somewhere, I assume someone designed the design. The minor premise is that design is all through the universe. We see design everywhere in the universe. The existence of this design is right with us all the time. So there must be a universal designer. If there is design, there must be a universal designer. And I'll come back in a few minutes after this break, and I'll give you some examples or some stories to demonstrate this argument from design. Welcome back, and I'll continue the argument on design. I'm Chris Noble. We're talking about Catholic apologetics, and this talk is, if you're tuning in late, the existence of God. Now, I'm talking about the argument from design, and I want to give a few examples of that argument. It's the easiest one to share with people, like I said. The first example is about the watchmaker and the box. Now, imagine that somebody came to you with a box, and in it were all a bunch of pieces of a watch, all spread around. The watch wasn't put together. It was all spread around. And they said, put this in a warm place for 21 days, and you'll have a watch. A watch will be put together. Well, of course, if you do that, it won't be put together. Now, if someone came to you with an egg in a box and said, put that in a warm place for 21 days, you'd have a little chick come out, something that is a million times more magnificent than the watch. And that chick obviously came from some kind of design or purpose, because you do something willful, you do something on purpose to put it somewhere, to make it hatch, and you see that there's something behind the existence of the chick. Chance is really, an explanation for the universe of that there is chance is an improbable explanation for the universe. It takes more faith to believe that there's no designer than there is a designer in the universe. There's a story of the atheist and the Christian who are at Mission Control in Houston, and they're about to send a rocket off to the moon. And the Christian said to the atheist, "Isn't it wonderful that this rocket's going to go to the moon and hit it by chance?" And the atheist says, "What do you mean by chance? There are millions of man hours put into this rocket." And the Christian says, "Well, then chance is not a good explanation for the rocket, but it is for the universe." A little bit later, they were walking down the street. They walked into a gallery, an art gallery, and the atheist admired the picture, and he said, "Gee, this is a beautiful picture. I wonder who painted it." And the Christian said, "No one, of course." You see, there are only two possibilities for something coming into existence, either by accident or it was purposely brought into existence by a designer, by somebody doing it. There's only two possibilities. And that's the same for the universe. Either the universe came out of nothing, came out of pure chance, or else there was a God who designed it. Peter Kraft, in a book called Catholic, The Fundamentals of Catholicism, said, "If the cosmic rays had bombarded the primordial slime at a slightly different angle, time, or intensity, the hemoglobin molecule necessary for all warm-blooded animals could never have evolved. The chance of this molecule's evolving is 1 trillion times 1 trillion. And then he goes on to say, this sounds suspiciously like a plot. You know, it's like there's something going on here if we look. We could multiply these examples by the hundreds. Everywhere we see order and design. Scientists are discovering that the universe is a finely tuned, finely balanced harmony of fundamental constants. In other words, that there is a basic consistency and sameness to the whole universe to an infinitesimal degree, to the tiniest particle. And for the universe to remain in existence, let alone come into existence, there has to be this constant, this fundamental constant of delicately balanced particles and forces in the universe. And that just sounds like a design. The Cambridge astronomer Fred Hoyle said that the possibility of life arising spontaneously of itself in the universe is being 1 × 10⁴. In other words, the possibility for that is absolutely phenomenal, extraordinary. It's beyond the mind. It's beyond comprehension. Could a million monkeys at a million typewriters type out Shakespeare's works? You know, that's the kind of thing that I think about when I think about these probabilities. He calls this probability something like a tornado coming through a junkyard and making a Boeing 747. That's the kind of probability we're looking at here. So that's the argument from design. The argument of first cause is the next argument I want to talk about. It's a very... These two arguments, by the way, took centuries to come to full fruition in Thomas Aquinas. The first cause is about there being a cause for every effect in the universe. Now, you know, humans have minds. We're very human. We have a mind. And we need explanations for things. Nothing exists without a reason. You know, the pop theory that everything pops into existence just doesn't do it. It just doesn't satisfy us. There's no reason to believe that the whole universe has popped into existence, because the whole universe is a vast interlocking chain of things that have come into existence. It's like we talk about nature being finely tuned and finely balanced and being everything's connected with another. We can see the chain of existence in nature. One thing depends upon another. Well, the universe is the same way. Now, if there's no first cause for this universe, the universe is not explained. There's no explanation for the universe. And I say to myself, that doesn't do. I can't take no explanation. If there's no first cause, the universe is like a great long chain with nothing holding it up. It's just a chain kind of floating out in space. It's just a meaningless hunk of chain. It's like... if the universe has no first cause, it's like a train moving down the tracks with no railroad pulling it, no engine, pulling it. It's just going down on its own power somewhere, and that's impossible. But that's what the universe is like with no first cause. It's unexplained. If there's no first cause, there is no being who is eternal, self-sufficient, transcendent, uncaused, perfect, as the first cause of the universe. And that's what ancient Jewish and Christian philosophy and theology, obviously, and revelation, of course, based upon revelation, came up with. That's what has come through us that is the first cause of the universe. You see, because either something causes itself, it's either exists by itself, I should say, or it does not exist by itself. You know, I didn't cause myself. I didn't bring myself into existence, and neither did you. Nobody did. Something brought the human race into existence. Something had to bring us into existence. God, who wasn't brought into existence, he was always existence itself, brought that which needs to depend on him into existence. The gift of existence is passed down through the chain to others. Now, if you don't believe there's a first cause passing that gift down that chain of existence to others, then nobody will get it. Nobody will get existence. But we did get existence. We have existence. And many theologians of the Church have always asked, well, if you don't believe in God, why is there reality? Ask yourself that question. Why is there what there is? You know, what is here? Why is it here? The argument from conscience. We'll go on pretty quickly here. The argument of conscience. Conscience is that gift that God gave us in our mind that discerns what is right and wrong. We know what's right and wrong in our minds and hearts. We're conscious of that. We're conscious of a moral obligation to do some things and to avoid others. We're aware of a moral reality, a moral order, if you will, a moral truth that springs from the deepest part of our being. Now, I am conscious of this conscience that I don't create. I don't create this conscience. It was here in me. This understanding and knowledge of right and wrong was already here in me when I was born. Now, what's the best evidence for a conscience, that there is a conscience? Well, C.S. Lewis said the best evidence is that people argue. give me that. That's not right that you take that. I was here first, but you promised to do this for me. You know, we all argue with other people. We all say that some people are wrong and some people are right. Well, what standard are we judging them by? There is a natural conscience in all of us, and we appeal to that all the time, usually for ourselves, you know, in a way that we want to get something for ourselves. But it's there. It's a standard of behavior that everybody appeals to. It's in us. There is a conscience in all of the human race. Now, today, authority is a dirty word, and the only authority that has any respect is the individual conscience. People say, I'll never do anything against my conscience. You know, I'm going to do what's right for my conscience. Well, you know, the Church agrees with that. That conscience has an absolute, exceptionless, binding moral authority over us, demanding unqualified obedience. That's what Aquinas said. But he also said that the conscience is darkened by sin and by passion and by impulses, and that it has to be fulfilled with God's revelation and God's truth, with the Ten Commandments, with the fulfillment of the natural conscience, the supernatural teaching. We need to have an informed conscience. We can't go on that alone. But only, the point is that only a perfectly righteous God, a perfectly divine will, can create such a conscience and has the authority and right to absolute obedience. The conscience is the voice of God, and Christ's teaching is the voice of God shouting at us rather than whispering to us in our conscience. It makes it much, much more clear. But the conscience is there. Now the question is, who put it there? How did it get there? How do I know what's right and wrong? And you'll find a universal moral code, an ethical code, in all cultures. The last argument for the existence of God is called Pascal's wager. And some people think this is the worst argument, but it's very good for skeptics. It's very good for skeptics. And I can remember it having an effect on me before I was a Christian. It appeals to the instinct of self-preservation. Now, imagine that there was a miracle drug and you were dying of an illness that this miracle drug could give you or promises to give you. Okay, you don't know. You have a 50-50 chance to live or die. Now, would you take it or would you not? Okay, I think most of us would take it. Okay, imagine you had a sweepstakes ticket for $1 million and there are two tickets left. There are two tickets left. One the winner, and you could have one of them for $5. Would you buy the ticket? Okay, I think most of us would buy the ticket. We would say yes, we would do that. We would gamble because the odds are pretty good. Now, deciding whether to believe in God is like these cases, but the stakes are much higher. Obviously, the stakes are ultimate. The stakes will determine our entire lives. Pascal said, God either is or he is not. God either is or he is not. We're back to our original question, does God exist, yes or no? Now, the thing is that reason alone can't ultimately decide this. Okay, we need faith. Ultimately, you just can't choose. But it's a choice of your will and of your heart. Now, if you choose God, you choose heads. And if you choose against God, you choose tails. Now, if God does exist and I choose God, I win. I win infinite happiness. I win infinite love, joy, peace, and all that. If you choose no and God does exist, you lose everything. Infinite wretchedness, infinite darkness, infinite misery. If you're a gambler, that's not a very good choice. I think Jimmy the Greek would choose yes, because he's a gambler and he knows the odds here. You know, he knows what could happen. Atheism is a terrible bet. If I chose God, I said, yes, there's a God, and he did not exist, the atheist was right, all I would be is foolish. All I would do is be foolish, but without the Spirit. I have this kind of hope that may be a little bit silly, but I'm just foolish. If he loses everything. You know, so why not make the bet? Now, some people say, I'm not going to make a bet at all. I just don't know whether God exists. I'm an agnostic. Well, there must be a wager. Why must there be a wager? Because we're all alive. We're living, and the choice is there. God is there for us, and the choice is forced upon us. We can escape it until we die, but then we can't escape it. And an agnostic is like a ship moving on water. It's sailing past the port. In the port is God. God's in that port. And the agnostic stays anchored. But there comes a point of no return. There comes a point of when the agnostic is going to have to choose. I say to some people, try. Just take a try and pray for 30 days. Read the scriptures. Read some document of the church. Or do whatever you can. And test it out. Test this out. You can test it out. God will answer your prayers. God will be there for you. He will not be the God of the fool who says God is not there. He will not be the God of the atheist who says he doesn't exist at all. But he will be a God for you if you just have faith. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.